Don't you wanna die happy with a smile on your face? Wake up a laughing, cause you're free of all the things that would hold you from your ocean view. Life's a landscape. Why don't you bathe in your way?
Do you think we're bad podcasters? Because we haven't done a podcast for about 6 months.
Doesn't make us bad podcasters, it just makes us busy people.
That's true. I wonder if other people think we're bodpaskers.
Maybe you're a podcaster because you say bod instead of bad.
Bodcaster.
A
bodcaster. Hey, I like that.
Bodcaster, what does that mean?
It's a bad podcaster. Well, hopefully people don't think that, and hopefully the people who watch and listen to How to Die Happy regularly are excited and ready to pick up.
They can't listen regularly because we haven't done any podcasts.
Oh, yeah, because we're podcasters. Okay, not so regularly.
Wouldn't it be a badcaster?
Badcaster! Yeah. Actually, near York is a little town called Tadcaster. Which I think is the home of John Smith's beer, if I recall.
Nice, you know you're rambling.
Well, we are literally rambling. I don't know if anybody can hear. Wait. Can you hear the birds? We're currently rambling through the Surrey Hills in the UK.
Walking a dog called Digby.
Yes, and that's the kind of one of the strange things, because we're doing an introduction in March 2024. In the UK for a podcast that we recorded in Bali.
In what, March 2023?
A long time ago. Okay, so anyway.
Who did we talk to?
We talked to Manesh Girin.
And what did we talk to him about?
Psychedelic science, or rather the science of psychedelics, which was a very interesting and exciting conversation, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. But we have to note that since doing the podcast, Manesh qualified, didn't he?
Yes, he was actually studying for his PhD, has since got his PhD. It's that long ago.
So congratulations.
Congrats to Manesh. And, well, lots has changed in that time, so we don't really need to go through all of that. Funnily enough, I've actually since pivoted and become a full-time psychedelic integration coach. But we can talk about that another time as well. And
we've just generally been freezing cold and wet in England.
Yeah, so we're looking forward to going back to Bali. Anyway, so we hope you enjoy this episode. It is all about the science of psychedelics. Manesh is involved with some big folks, actually, doing a lot of research in this space. And ultimately, this conversation provides, I think, some needed credibility to the conversation around the healing power of psychedelic plant medicines when used carefully and intentionally. So it's all about the mental health stuff. It's all about the science of psychedelics. Do you have anything else to say?
No, I would just say if you've managed to get to the end of this very long, rambly introduction, congratulations. Don't let it put you off because the episode is really good.
Because we're bad casters. Bye. Manesh, hi, how are you?
Hey, doing well. How are you?
Very good. Thank you very much. Very excited to have this conversation with you. So thanks for taking the time to come and see us.
Yeah, my pleasure. I'm excited to see where this chat goes.
Nice.
Where to start? You know, it's I don't know if you've had a chance to sort of check out our show, but we talk about psychedelics quite frequently. But more often than not, we're talking about psychedelics to shaman and to other psychonauts. We're psychonauts as well, so we do a lot of work with plant medicines, various shapes and sizes. But I was super excited when I came across you online because I wanted to give science a voice in this conversation about psychedelics. So I suppose the first question I had for you was, how did you become interested in psychedelic neuroscience and mental health.
Yeah, for sure. And it was through my own personal journey. And pretty early on, it was in my late teens. The number I usually give is around 16 to 17, but I don't quite remember exactly when. But to not, you know, make it into an hour long story, around that time, I had, through various ways, been introduced to Buddhism, actually, and meditation and Eastern spirituality. And I had been, there was this career counselor at my high school who I used to go and hang out with sometimes at lunchtime. He's like this really interesting, quirky old man who nobody really liked except for me. I had a connection with him for some reason. And one day he gave me this book. It's called The Three Pillars of Zen by Roshi Kaplow, Philip Kaplow. It's a very famous book on Zen. And he said, oh, I think you'll understand. I think you'll get this. I think you'll be, you know, interested in this. And then I read it and, you know, was fascinated just by the concept of meditation, which was foreign to me at the time, and of enlightenment and of purifying and stilling the mind for insight in all these things. And so then that got me interested in the whole area of like consciousness, the mind, spirituality. And somehow or another, I stumbled upon the work by LSD psychiatrist Stanislav Grof, who was a pioneer in the mid-60s to 70s, right? Pioneer in LSD psychotherapy. And I was like, okay, interesting. Psychedelics, like magic mushrooms and these things that I've been taught that make you go crazy, that they, like they're hard drugs, actually can induce experiences similar to those, you know, reported by mystics and yogis and so on.
Right.
And so then that gave me a sense of openness towards psychedelics. And then a friend of mine got some mushrooms from her older sister, and we did it at the beach one summer. And that experience really, you know, the main thing it did for me was it showed me the separation between me and my thoughts and my identity. And I was able kind of to step back from my usual way of perceiving the world and myself and see things from this panoramic perspective. And I saw just how, like, as humans, we're so myopic, we're so tunnel vision, we have our own kind of frame on reality, and we live within that usually, right? And I was like, wow, there's so many more potential ways to perceive the world. And that basically, since our perception of reality is basically our reality, because we can only see it through our perception, it changes our reality. And I was like, oh, how can I, you know, have a great understanding of how our reality is constructed, how it could be changed? And psychedelics seem to be the window into that. And so I was fascinated to study that in a way, you know, basically at first I was like, how can I make a career out of researching this? And I was like, oh, being a scientist. And then through a variety of ways, I got into brain imaging and neuroscience at the perfectly right time, just as psychedelic neuroscience was taking off. And so here I am.
Beautiful. Nice. That was an incredible story. Do you know, I often wonder how many scientists working with psychedelics are actually proactively using them. That might sound like a dumb thing to say. I don't know. Are you aware? Is everybody in the space working with psychedelics in some way, shape, or form?
Yeah, it's funny. If you were to ask most scientists in a public context, they'd probably deny it or downplay it. But behind closed doors, we all do it, and everyone enjoys it. Everyone usually has some kind of relationship to it. So yeah, that's my answer.
I think you have to. I think it's. I don't know about you, but because we talk about psychedelics quite a lot, and I recently published a book called How to Die Happy, in which I also refer to master plants and their place in expanding one's consciousness. But I've had some criticism from the public, if you like, and also attending going on other podcasts talking about this, where the podcasters are very quick to point out to their audience, you know, we don't endorse these things, just so you know. More often than not, though, the criticism comes from people, when you dig down, it comes from people who've never actually done any work with psychedelics. They've just been programmed by the media and let's face it, government and health authorities over recent decades to believe these things are the devil's work.
Yeah, definitely. A lot of people are just not informed. And for psychedelic researchers and professionals, a lot of the time it's to avoid looking kind of wishy-washy, or like that they drank the Kool-Aid and now they're trying to prove their, you know, assumptions through research instead of genuinely trying to study them and in an objective way, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's a concern amongst researchers in particular that sharing about their own use is going to make them less likely to get funding, maybe less likely to get a faculty position at a university, and this, you know, otherwise harm the reputation as an objective researcher. And for me personally, you know, initially when I started being on podcasts and things, I would avoid questions like that and not answer it. But nowadays I have no intention of pursuing an academic career, and so I can care less about that. And I also think that people, I think scientists should do it because it gives you an insider perspective, and it could be rich for creating new hypotheses, having new perspectives on how they work, and having a deeper understanding. Otherwise, you're just working with language and abstractions and numbers, you know, without any pure raw experience to back it, right? And I think there's a lot of limitations there as well.
Yeah, I was just thinking a minute ago that I would love to work with psychedelics with scientists.
What an incredible journey that could be. We were talking about this the other day. We would love to do a psilocybin ceremony with a load of quantum physicists.
That would be fun.
Can you imagine that? But it begs the question, doesn't it? who should people be providing scientific reports and advice, if you like, that therefore leads government and therefore leads the populace, if these people aren't truly familiar with the transformative effects of these medicines?
Yeah, I think both types of people play a role, right? I think the people who haven't had a relationship with them and haven't experienced any changes in their life from it are valuable in researching these drugs, because then they truly provide a objective stance on it, in the sense that, you know, they're literally operating in the world of what they've read, right? They're a reflection of what the literature says, as opposed to what the drugs really are. And that can be useful, because then they give a sense of like how people would perceive it based on the research world alone. You know what I mean? But I feel like the richness and depth will come from people who've actually experimented and experienced with them. But I think there's value in people who haven't as well, from that perspective, just as a kind of feedback on what the literature is like and what, you know, independent of the experience, what are people thinking about these drugs?
Yeah, for sure. I think one thing we can say for sure is that the psychedelic renaissance is very much receiving some wind in its sails, which can't be a bad thing for any of us. I wonder, could you provide an overview of the current scientific understanding of how psychedelics interact with the brain and our mental health?
For sure. So a lot of the research with psychedelics, and when I say psychedelics, I'm mainly referring to psilocybin, you know, which is a compound in magic mushrooms, LSD, and then DMT, and /ayahuasca, which is the shamanic brew that contains DMT, as well as another compound that, you know, prevents it from being broken down in your stomach. And the thing that these drugs share in common is that they activate a particular receptor called the serotonin 2A receptor. And we know from studies in humans and with mice that if you block this receptor and give somebody a psychedelic, they're not going to have a psychedelic experience, and it has very little effects on them. And so this suggests that receptor in particular is very important for psychedelic effects. And so what's interesting about this receptor is it's located in parts of our brain that are very influential and that play a big role in a lot of cognitive processes. So a lot of aspects of our thinking that make us uniquely human. So our ability to basically think about things that are not in the here and now, to be able to draw on memories, to imagine the future, remember the past, to think about what other people are thinking about, to be able to create a personal narrative, and to do all these complex cognitive functions. And so this receptor is located on those regions, which also overlaps with the default mode network, which a lot of people talk about. And so just in virtue of that, it's like, okay, psychedelics are going to be affecting those parts of the brain, which are involved, again, in these advanced aspects of our thinking. And so the idea is that by activating this receptor, psychedelics kind of perturb or alter the brain activity underlying what constructs our experience. And that, you know, one way of framing this is that by doing that, it kind of reduces the stability of the frameworks that we bring to interpret our lives and our experience. And what's an example? So like relevant for mental health, let's say, you know, as a child, given your interactions with your, you know, parents or with your peers, you internalize the idea that I am, you know, I'm a defective human being. I'm not worthy of success. And that belief is going to be encoded in these brain regions and is going to influence how you perceive your life, how you interpret interactions with other people, how you emotionally respond to situations, and can later down the line potentially set you up for some kind of mental health condition, right? And this is all because of this belief you've internalized. And so psychedelics, by hitting that receptor in that part of the brain, can kind of shake that up a bit, so that belief and other beliefs are no longer as stable and solid, and that opens our perspective to seeing things in a new light and potentially revising those beliefs. And so psychedelics, by like basically shaking our snow globe, shaking up our ingrained interpretations and frameworks we bring to the world, give us the opportunity to then change them and revise them when we're properly supported with therapy before and after and with the right intention and all these things.
Shaking our snow globe. I like that. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they provide the ability for us to unlearn, right? Which I think is quite a fascinating thing in itself. My own history was I was an alcoholic and cocaine addict for many, many years. And I was first introduced to ayahuasca and San Pedro. So I did a weekend of DMT, mescaline, DMT, mescaline. That was my first introduction. And it's safe to say that that it changed my life forever. There's no simpler way to put it. Yeah, I mean, I was sober, but I was in the throes of a third nervous breakdown. I think it's safe to say I would have used again. But I largely thank those medicines for putting an end to any addictive tendencies I have. Certainly to the point. I mean, I still look like a cake, don't I?
Yeah, maybe we need to get you worked up with that.
Still like a cake, but apart from that, yeah. I mean, so I mean, I'm a fan, but of course, many people aren't they? So because all of these people, so many people, in fact, hold the misconception that psychedelics are a dangerous drug or a collection of dangerous drug. For the skeptics, can you explain the potential benefits for psychedelics as medicines to treat mental illness?
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of the fear around psychedelics come from their use in very like irresponsible contexts, right? Mm-hmm. So the thing with psychedelics is that they're not like other drugs in the sense that if you take alcohol and if you drink enough alcohol, you know you're going to get drunk, you're going to get hammered, right? It's a very predictable set of effects that you're going to go through. If you take a stimulant drug, you're going to be, you know, going to get have more energy and focus. It's very predictable. But with psychedelics, it can go in a whole variety of different directions depending on what you're doing, where you are, how you're feeling at the time that you ingest it, and so on, right? And so I think, you know, there's a lot of portrayal in the media and other places that psychedelics are going to put you down this dark, you know, rabbit hole. You're going to lose your mind. You're going to lose control, all these things. And that can happen, right? If you take a high dose and you're not prepared and you do it in an environment that's negative or you're around the wrong people or you're not grounded in yourself at the time, then it could take you to those places. But where psychedelics have so much potential is when they're done in a very intentional way. Right, you're doing it like in the studies, which have shown that psychedelics can be effective as a treatment for depression, for anxiety disorders, for substance use disorders, and for several other things. They're doing a lot of preparatory work, asking the person, like, you know, what's your relationship to your mental health condition? What have you done before? Where do you think it comes from? What's your intentions for the journey? And also telling them that you know. During the experience, you're going to be safe and secure. You have to surrender. You have to be well. You're going to be well supported and come in feeling grounded, right? And then in the session, you do it in a very controlled environment that's meant to make you feel safe and secure and at home, so you can really let go and not be distracted by the energy of people around you or what have you. And, you know, all these contextual factors that you package the experience in really direct it in a particular way that's very different than doing it with friends or at a festival or whatever. And I think when done in that way, psychedelics can induce these profound experiences where you have insights into your life and your relationships, be able to see things in your life from a new perspective. Often people will relive memories or have, you know, long repressed memories come up so they can process it. And usually these memories are affecting them kind of behind the scenes without them knowing it and contributing to mental health patterns and kind of really just allow you to excavate your mind and your psyche to then see things from a new perspective and integrate it in a new way. And again, this is like difficult work. A lot of fear and anxiety can come up, and this is why it's so important to be in a context where you feel safe and secure and able to go into these deep, dark places.
Yeah.
And so again, like psychedelics are powerful and they can take you into bad trips where you feel like you're going crazy, losing control, and in deep pits of anxiety and fear. But they can also take you to the total opposite where you feel like you're in kind of blissful oneness with God and the universe and one with nature, and you're experiencing joy and euphoria and love like you've never experienced in your life and seeing everything in a new perspective. That's also very possible and more likely to happen when you take all these precautions into account. And so,
yeah.
So psychedelics have a huge potential for mental health, for sure.
You make a valid point. It's something we talk about all the time, and it's set, setting, and guide. Now, obviously, I'm referring to the shamanic process rather than the clinical process, but it's still the same thing. If you think about it, you have to have the right mindset when you go into this. You have to be in the right environment, as you've explained, a safe place, and you must have a very qualified guide who can hold space. Be that a shaman, or of course you or one of your colleagues providing psychedelic assisted therapy.
And Manesh, you talk about this a lot on your I was watching one of your videos the other day, I think it was on your YouTube channel, and you do a segment about set and setting, you know, and but it's been really interesting watching those, the way you talk about it and then bringing the science side of it, for me has been fascinating. But yeah, the set and setting, definitely important.
Obviously, I'm interested in what's going on in the psychedelic assisted therapy space in terms of what sort of what's being allowed by government and health authorities, because it seems it's going down a specific route. And I wondered if you'll be able to elaborate a lot more. But rather than doing work with, for example, ayahuasca, San Pedro, the two of the Iboga, some of the classic really potent medicines, it seems that a lot more of the work is going down the psilocybin and MDMA and ketamine route. Would you be able to explain that a little bit more for us?
Yeah, definitely. So the reason for ketamine's usage and its common usage in mental health context is because it was approved by the FDA long ago, and so it's available to be used in what's called an off-label way for mental health conditions such as depression. So it's the only legally accessible psychedelic right now. It was approved in 1970 as an anesthetic, and when a drug is approved for anything, if there's sufficient evidence, doctors can prescribe it for other things, you know, for which there's evidence, and depression is one of those. And so the emphasis on ketamine is because of that reason. And then as for psilocybin, I think part of it is because, one, people like the concept that it's a mushroom, right? That it's a naturally occurring thing. And then two, the first modern clinical trial on psychedelic, like in the 21st century, was with psilocybin. And so I think that set a precedent for psilocybin as the drug of choice. And so because of that, people have just jumped onto that and it's kind of snowballed and accumulated. And it's like, oh, psilocybin is the way to go. I think that's mainly why. And then LSD also is avoided a lot of time, for example, because it's very long, 10 to 12 hours. And therapist time is expensive. It's more difficult if it's a really long experience. And then with ayahuasca, I think part of the reason why it hasn't been used more is because one, it's more associated with a particular ceremonial context of linking it to the Shipibo tradition or Santo Daime or these other churches and things that use in a very ceremonial context. And also have different versions of the brew, so it's less pharmacologically precise. And it's a mixture of two drugs, and that makes it harder for regulators a lot of the time as well.
Well, that makes sense. Thanks for clearing that up. I was just, I did some research for my book on the subject, and I found a number of studies. Obviously, since the 1950s, they were working with LSD, weren't they? But of course, that all got shut down in the so-called war of drugs. But I came across a number of studies. 2006, Moreno et al. In treating obsessive compulsive disorder using psilocybin, all patients showed improvements within 24 hours of treatment. 2011, Grob et al., psilocybin treatment of anxiety and depression in end-stage cancer patients showed significant reductions in anxiety at 3 months and depression at 6 months. 2014, Johnson et al., long-term chronic smoking was studied using psilocybin. 80% of the group remained abstinent after 6 months. 2014, Gasser et al., anxiety linked to a life-threatening disease was studied using LSD, resulting in significant decreases at 2 months, sustained for 12 months, only two left. 2015, Bogenschutz et al., treating alcohol dependence with psilocybin showed a significant decrease in drinking behavior for up to 9 months. 2015, Osorio FDE et al. And 2016, Sanchez et al. Major depressive disorder was studied using ayahuasca and showed significant decreases in depressive symptoms for up to 21 days. And the list goes on. I think the point is, and obviously one of the reasons why I wanted to get you on the show was, there is, we have a large portion of the populace who, which is perfectly fair enough, will only trust the science. That's the way they live their life. They're not so open to, shall we say, metaphysics, spiritual conversations, discussions of an ethereal nature. But there is science, isn't there? There's loads of it that has proven for many years and is, it's safe to say, hell-bent on now proving that these medicines work. Where can people find this kind of information? Is there an easy database for people to do research along these lines? Of course, they could follow you, couldn't they?
Yeah, that's part of it. Yeah, you could follow me. But there's also a number of good resources out there. There's psychedelicreview.com, I believe is the website there. There is Blossom Psychedelic Insights, which is a great repository of research and summaries. Third Wave is another organization, a psychedelic education organization. Psychedelic Spotlight is another one. Double Blind is another one. Yeah, there's a whole variety of them. And so it's very easy. If you get connected into the space, it's very easy to find quality education on various aspects of the research.
Yeah, that's a great point. I forgot about Double Blind magazine. Interesting, you mentioned earlier on, and it's something that a lot of people, I don't know about you, but when I started working with these medicines, I made some significant changes to my life. I lived in London and I moved to Bali. I closed down my business. I sold and gave away everything I owned. They say you're not supposed to make any life-changing decisions for 3 months after an ayahuasca journey. 3 days later, I made all these changes and closed down my business within a month, and I moved to Bali. And so some of the people from my old life, if you like, my older friends, they watch. Obviously, they see me publishing a book. They watch. They listen and watch to the podcast. They watch me on social media, and they're interested because they can see that my life has drastically changed, improved beyond imagination. So they are interested in psychedelics. But one of the common responses I often get from people is, "Yeah, I'm really interested, but I just don't want to lose control." I don't know if that's something you've come across. And I wonder if we might sort of dive into that a little bit. You know, why is it that we don't want to lose control? What's the ego doing?
Yeah, that's a really good one. It is a common one for people who've never tried it, as a fear of losing control.
I had it.
Did you?
Yeah.
What, with ayahuasca?
Yeah, but even when I was younger, even with drinking, I never wanted to drink too much because I didn't like that losing control. So for me, that letting go moment and like just going for it. It's hard on.
Yeah.
Manish? It's quite interesting. Even there is scientific research that has found that people who are more able to surrender and let go of things from the rest of their day, for example, are more likely to have mystical spiritual experiences and positive effects. And so there's evidence to that idea that you got to really let go. And I think there's a lot of things wrapped up into that. I think part of it is personality. People who are high on conscientiousness often are a bit more like things to be very orderly and kind of have all their ducks in a row and in control, in a sense, be able to control their lives. And so then people who are high on conscientiousness, as well as neuroticism, are more likely to have fear and anxiety come up. That's not to say that could be something that's worked on, but more preparation is needed for them. And I think, you know, if you think about fear of letting go, this comes down to a lack of trust. It's a lack of trusting that if you allow, you know, things to happen as they happen, it's the belief that it might go somewhere bad instead of being open, it's going to go somewhere positive.
Yeah, it's like a predisposed idea, isn't it?
Often that behavior is learned. Mm-hmm. Is like the learned idea that you need to manage things in order for things to be okay. And that can happen in a variety of different childhood environments and related to maybe attachment, attunement dynamics or the primary caregiver from an early age. I think it's related to the idea of kind of being able to go explore beyond the known into uncertainty and the unknown and being kind of comfortable leaving a safe base into the external territories, right? And where anything can happen. And so I think it goes hand in hand with a whole variety of things in life, I believe. But I do think the ability to let go of surrender is a core aspect of positive mental health and flourishing and well-being.
Yeah, I totally agree. I suppose it's a bit of a catch-22, isn't it, if you think about it? Because certainly my own extensive experience working with psychedelics is that one of the great gifts that psychedelic use gives us is the disillusion of ego. Depending on what kind of doses you're working with, but if you are working with heroic doses, you can quite regularly experience that kind of thing. But then, of course, it's ego that doesn't want to be dissolved. So so there's this constant battle, isn't there? No, I am here to protect you. I am your identity. I am a dense layer cake of, well, let's face it, illusion, but all the same, I am you. So you don't want to dissolve me, otherwise what's going to happen next? So there's this I can see the conundrum. The internal debate.
Yeah, totally. So yeah, it comes down to not listening to the mind, I think.
Yes, absolutely.
And just doing what your mind's telling you not to do.
Yeah, and as you say, that all comes down to surrender, which for some is absolutely easier than others. I fully appreciate. But ultimately, for anyone listening to the show who is considering working with psychedelics, I would say you've just got to lean into that. You really do just have to lean into that. You've got to let go. I've sat in ceremonies with people before who could not let go, and they had a troublesome journey. You know, they struggled to really flow with it because their ego was so strong. They were fighting it. So how do you see psychedelics fitting into the larger landscape of mental health treatment then in the future?
I think we're very much on track for MDMA to be available for PTSD by end of 2024 in North America, at least. And then psilocybin by 2027 is usually the projections given, assuming the clinical trials continue as they have been. It'll be available for psilocybin for depression by 2027. And I think, you know, it's going to be a push into existing healthcare infrastructure in a lot of cases because, you know, the way you use them is quite different than standard drugs, right? You take a standard SSRI antidepressant and you just get prescribed that by your GP or psychiatrist and you take it home, take it every day. Whereas with psilocybin and MDMA, you know, what a psychiatrist or GP is going to do is give you a referral to a psychedelic clinic or center where you then you have to go and do it under supervision in that context. And then it's okay. So then what's the standardized therapy model that's going to be provided? Is it going to be standardized? What are the variants of therapy that are going to be provided? What's the framework that's going to be used, right? Because obviously, as we've talked about a little bit, these different drugs have different cultural contexts in which their use has been. And so are we just going to take them out of the context and give a generic decontextualized version of it to appeal to everybody? Or is there going to be different kinds, different flavors for different types of people? And how much therapy? And there's like so many things and things that take a lot of time and will be very expensive too. And so there's a lot of questions on how it's going to fit in, but it's going to demand a new model for mental health treatments for sure.
And well, is it likely that microdosing would be included in that? But then obviously with microdosing, you're more likely to be given it to take on your own at home, aren't you, rather than under supervision. So with...
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, yeah, the microdosing would be more amenable to the standard kind of way of giving drugs. But there's no research yet suggesting that microdosing is effective for mental health conditions. There just isn't. Mm-hmm. There's no clinical trial looking at it that is period. There's no clinical trial looking at microdosing for depression, for example. And the studies outside of mental health treatments, the jury's still out on how much it is effective more than placebo. A lot of studies have found that it's not more effective than placebo. And so there's a lot of questions around microdosing. And I think public perception of microdosing is far out of step with the actual research.
That's interesting.
And we just need a lot more studies on that.
I didn't know that. What's your take on microdosing?
I think there is a lot of placebo effect going on, which doesn't mean it's not real. It just means that a lot of the effects people are getting are not the drug itself, but a belief in the drug combined with some drug effect, right? Which is always the case, but I think the balance between them is quite evenly matched, or perhaps even more placebo. But the thing is, there's a few important points about the research. One, most of them involve just giving one microdose when you come into a lab, you know, as opposed to people taking on some regular schedule for weeks and weeks at a time, after which they, you know, might get cumulative benefits. So that kind of long-term use has only really been studied, long-term at-home use has only really been studied in one or two studies. And they're not that large, you know, as compared to what's needed to really understand how they're working and whether they're working. And moreover, there's lack of studies on mental health conditions, as I just said. And so for me, if I'm going to go strictly based on the literature, it does suggest that placebo effects played the major part. And yes, people are getting better, but the people who got the sugar pill got just as good as just as better as the people who got the microdose, right? Mm. In multiple studies. And so that says a lot. But I think another aspect of this is that microdosing, I think just like psychedelics, depend on set and setting to some extent. And what that means in the context of microdosing is it's not that you just take microdoses and magically you're better. It's like microdosing can enhance what you're already doing, the techniques and practices that you're doing.
Bear with us, Manish, we've lost you.
Mm-hmm.
All right, okay, you're back. I'm just have hidden your video. Sorry, we got you. So I should have explained Squadcast. If you haven't used it before, it records locally as well. So so regardless of a poor internet connection, everything you say there won't be any interruption. It's recorded locally on your drive and then it's uploaded to the browser. So when we finish the session,
okay, great.
Please leave your browser open for a little while. Don't shut it down immediately. Mm-hmm. And that way we'll be guaranteed to get the whole thing. Microdosing. I think obviously I know a lot of people work with that.
Well, it's interesting because so many people microdose these days. It's almost like become a fashionable thing.
It has.
But it's obviously benefiting people, so whether it's the placebo effect or not, it's doing something, and people are like really improving their mental health.
Anecdotally, yeah, there are a lot of people saying it's a great thing. I want to go back to something you said actually, Minesh, about how, because I fundamentally believe that the emergence of these medicines and their use will absolutely rattle the entire mental health treatment sphere. And I came across a study which I put in my book actually. And there's a 2021 study that said 75% of therapists reported they would be unlikely to provide psychedelic therapy if it meant a reduction in income. Now, of course, bearing in mind that lots of people in the space say, you know, one ayahuasca ceremony can be compared to 10 years in therapy. What's your opinion on that?
Oh, man. I'm curious. Was that a survey in the UK or North America?
No, it was in the US, actually.
It was in the US. Okay. Interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting one. I mean, it's kind of unfortunate because it suggests that they care more about money than healing their patients or clients.
Right.
Yeah, it's interesting. The principle of psychedelic therapy is often that, yeah, you only need to do a limited number of sessions and then you're presumably better off for the long term. But I think that's not the case for everybody. And a lot of these studies, sure, they look at maybe 3 months, 6 months, maybe a year, and have been finding that many people have sustained benefits at the 6 month, 12 month mark. But there are decreases in the reductions, and it's not everybody. On average, people are getting better, but if you look in the weeds of it, out of 15 people, there's probably like, you know, 5 or 6 who didn't get any benefit at all, or maybe even got worse. And so that's hidden in the stats a lot of the time. And so I think even though there will be some people who maybe have less trauma or have a more simple presentation of the condition, might just be able to do 3 sessions and maybe ongoing therapy for a couple months and then be good for the long term, not need to return. But I think there's going to be a large, significant portion of people who will have these experiences and will maybe need to do like 5 to 10 over a year or something with ongoing psychotherapy to really have lasting benefit. And so I think there's going to be all types of patients. And so not everyone's just going to be better in the way that people are expecting, to be honest. And so I'm not too concerned about that. It's more about how making sure insurance covers it, so these sessions are affordable for people. Because 8 hours with a therapist, doing that once a month, that's a lot of money already, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But then I suppose if the insurance people, whoever do the calculations of these things, then do the long-term calculation, it may well be a short-term intense bout of time required, but then it's not required for 10 years, is it? Which obviously some people do continue to see therapists for 4 decades. That's an interesting, you know, in terms of how psychiatrists currently work, I'm right in suggesting that the medical health professionals are incentivized to prescribe drugs. Is that right?
Yeah, for usually, example, yeah. Often they either even, yeah.
For example, SSRIs. So there is an incentive for them to write that script for someone to get on antidepressants.
Yes, I believe so. There often is, and there, I'm not sure what the status is now, but at least in the past, they get a cut, they get a commission for it, basically, and they have pharma companies in their pockets, and it's a whole controversy in the history of psychiatry, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's... I find that a blatant conflict of interest personally, but I suppose 100%. As these as psilocybin is eventually distributed in a capsule in a prescription, then I suppose the same thing will happen then, will it not?
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, it would happen, but yeah, again, it's not like anytime soon they're going to be giving high doses of psilocybin for people to take home. It's more so a referral to a clinic is what the model is going to be, at least for the first, I don't know, 5 years, maybe longer.
Yeah, so then it'll all be in a clinical setting. Well, when you do, because I know you're also the chief research officer for a psychedelic-assisted therapy business. Is that correct?
Yes.
Can we talk about that on this show?
Yeah, for sure.
It's called Ethniotech, is that right?
Yeah, Entheotech.
Oh,
yeah.
Entheotech, my bad. I always mispronounce stuff on this show. And now, because I am obviously, I think psychedelic assisted therapy gets thumbs up from the How to Die Happy podcast. Yeah. We're really, really happy that this is happening. And it seems that the organization you're working with, at least from checking out the website, is very progressive. I wondered if you could talk to us a little bit more about the psychedelic assisted therapy process. For example, you know, how does someone get involved with it? What does it entail? What kind of doses are you working with and what medicines?
For sure. So at this clinic, we're currently only doing ketamine because that's the only thing legally available through a doctor's referral. That said, there are ways through the Canadian government to allow legal access to psilocybin and MDMA on a case-to-case basis. And we've had, I think, 3 or 4 people have legal psilocybin therapy sessions at our clinic, even before a regulation at the federal level. But right now, our main thing is that we're a ketamine clinic until regulations change for MDMA and psilocybin. And so what the process is like for ketamine, and it's going to be similar for psilocybin and MDMA, is that a patient who has tried, let's say for depression, let's say they're a depressed patient, they've tried 3 SSRI drugs, they've tried psychotherapy, nothing has really done the trick for them. Their doctor will then refer them to our clinic to try out ketamine. It's like, try out their ketamine therapy model, because ketamine has been found to work in so-called treatment-resistant patients, as has psilocybin for depression. And so then a physician will refer them to our clinic, and then they'll go through our intake process, and then they'll be screened by our head of psychiatry. So a psychiatrist will screen them to make sure they're fit for using ketamine. You know, they don't have any pre-existing heart conditions or other contraindications, that, you know, they seem to be in a psychologically sound enough place to try it. And then after that, they go through a couple sessions of psychotherapy with a psychotherapist also on our team, who will ask them, you know, how does your depression show up for you? Where do you think it comes from? What do you think are the main blocks you have that are producing it? And these kinds of questions. And then also, what is your intention for ketamine? This is what the ketamine experience is going to be like. This is what it's like logistically. These are the expectations you can have about treatment. Here's how it works, maybe a little bit on that. And there's a lot of that preparatory and educational psychotherapy. And then they'll come in for a dose in our clinic, and we do it intramuscular. So intramuscular injection of ketamine of around, it's by weight. These numbers probably won't mean much to people in your audience, or maybe either you two, but it's something around 0.5 to 1 milligram per kilogram of body weight, which is a quite strong dose. So you're literally going on an internal ketamine journey where you're fully, you lose all sense of being in a room and of having a body, and you're on this internal dreamlike experience, which is very, quite strong. And then, so you go through that under the supervision of a nurse in our clinic, in a comfortable, you know, room that we've designed. And then after that, there's follow-up psychotherapy sessions, help you, like, what happened in your experience? What came up? How do you think it relates to your life? What changes are you going to make moving forward? What are concrete steps you're going to take based on that? And then we monitor and follow up with you through an app, and you maybe come in for additional sessions after that. So that's kind of the process. And I think that's how, yeah, psychedelic psychotherapy will be delivered in the future too.
What's the break between them working with the medicine and then actually having the first therapy session, psychotherapy session?
Yeah, there's a follow-up from our psychotherapist 24 hours later. And we're with you for until the effects completely subside, obviously, and then make sure you're taken home with somebody else and so on the day of.
Nice. So there's a kind of almost a seamless integration process then in that case.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You got any questions for Manish?
No, I'm just really fascinated with all this. I think it's for me, like, I think it comes with the way that we've been taught about drugs growing up. You know, like, as soon as I hear of ketamine therapy, that was always one of the ones that was like, oh, that's the bad one, you know, but now it's being really, really used in therapies, and it's obviously really helping people. So I'm just I'm excited that this is coming out and that there's people like you sharing this so we can start kind of to change that mindset on what's good and what's bad, you know. And I think often actually that's why sometimes we have difficult journeys, because we have this differentiation between good and bad and we've been told what's good and what's bad. Yeah. But I'd love to know, actually, going a little off course, like, what inspired you to really start sharing this with people? You know, obviously you're the psychedelic scientist and you're getting a lot of this information out to people that otherwise wouldn't have had access to it. And I'd love to know why you started that.
Yeah, definitely. I think part of it was seeing psychedelics really hit the mainstream and seeing it come up in the media and like a lot of different outlets and in the news and all these things. And a lot of the time, feeling like how it was presented was not adequate or not ideal and not in tune with the actual research literature. And so I benefit from being interested in psychedelics for a long time. You know, I've been somehow publicly interested in psychedelics since maybe 2012, 2013. And I'm only 29. So that was like, I was only 19 years old, but I was starting student clubs and being very vocal about it from a young age. And then as soon as I was, you know, as soon as I had sufficient education, maybe during my undergraduate, starting to read the research literature, which would have been like 7 or 8 years ago. And so I have a very deep understanding, I believe, just because it's been in my world for so long. And so when I see people coming in after a few months or a year, and I could tell when they don't really know what they're talking about. And a lot of articles are quite sensationalistic a lot of time. And basically all these things combined, I was like, okay, I'm in a great position to articulate these things in a way that's nuanced and reflective of the research, but also that's understandable by lay people. Mm-hmm. And so during the pandemic, I had a lot more free time. And so then that's when I made my YouTube channel. And then that got me a lot of attention and so many opportunities, including my, my position as chief research officer of this company. And I've just really grown to enjoy educating and sharing knowledge. And it's an excuse for me to learn more deeply, to be able to convey it in a way that people understand. And again, lots of great feedback, and recently launched a course for doctors, therapists, and lay people on psychedelic neuroscience, which has been quite successful, and just pushing forward and really enjoying it.
The course, that's an 8-week course, is that right?
Yeah, so it's in collaboration with the psychedelic media company called Psychedelics Today.
Do you want to talk about that?
You can get continuing education credits, and yeah, for sure. Yeah, so that course is it's a comprehensive 8-week course with weekly live sessions and about 10 hours total of recorded content covering psychedelic neuroscience from the basics all the way up. And we talk specifically about what we call serotonergic psychedelics, which is the ones you've been talking about, psilocybin, LSD, mescaline, DMT, ayahuasca, and also ketamine and MDMA. So how these work at the level of the brain, what's the research on how they affect different psychological processes, how that relates to clinical approaches. And we talk a lot about neuroplasticity and also effects on the nervous system and immune system, gut microbiome. We also talk a bit about meditation and microdosing. Like we hit all the topics and just covering the research in this 8-week course.
Wow.
And yeah, Schmog people can use it for things. Yeah, it's all the things. But I'm co-teaching it with a friend and colleague of mine. She has a PhD in neuroscience and has a background in education as well, and taught at Columbia University in the States. And me and her designed this together, and we're teaching it. And yet people can use it for continuing education credits. I'm not sure if that's a North American thing only, but that's people in certain professions, I believe, like therapists and psychotherapists, they're required to take additional courses over their career. And this can be used as official credits towards that as well.
Would you say that's a nice segue for a traditional, let's say, addiction psychologist who wanted to spread their wings into psychedelic assisted therapy?
I think it could be, yeah. Especially if they're interested more in how they work and why they're effective. We cover whether they work and some of the clinical findings, but it's more so on this is why at the level of the brain, it seems to have these effects. And here's how you can understand it at a deeper level to then interpret your experiences, interpret the experience of clients, and just have more of a rigorous background to share these things with people in general. Mm. So for that, yeah, I think it's great. And a lot of our members are people like that for sure, the current students.
But you take lay people too?
Yeah, we take anybody, yeah.
Might sign up to that.
Yeah.
I like the sound of Manish's course. we're planning to start retreats. And so obviously, you know, as we already are trip sitters, we already sit in ceremony and with shaman and help facilitate. I serve rape, you know, the South American snuff medicine. But I'm very keen to, you know, wrap this experience up. And I think that another reason why we wanted to talk to you was to see where these two worlds come together. And I suppose I'm interested to ask you about that, actually, in terms of, you know, with this resurgence of interest in psychedelic medicine, I can't help but consider the original wisdom keepers in all of this, the people that have been actually talking about this for thousands of years, and largely the West have ignored it, and that is the shaman, so, and the shamanic processes. So I'm interested, how do you see the role of shamanism and this wisdom keeping integrating with this newfound evolution of the, you know, the medical industrial complex's adoption of psychedelic medicines?
Yeah, definitely. I think it needs to be acknowledged that these medicines, you know, drugs, substances, whatever you want to call them, have been used for a long time in these cultures in a very specific way. And there's a lot of knowledge and wisdom there that we can learn from. But I think at the same time, it's not that we should give up all of our scientific medical understanding and just take on what they've been doing. Like, there needs to be an interaction between the two. We can learn from them, they can learn from us. And I think that, you know, the synergy between these two things is the way forward, not romanticizing the past or, you know, romanticizing our current knowledge as if we have it all figured out. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, having, honoring and finding any ways to reciprocate and acknowledge these traditions, but then, you know, finding ways to optimally integrate them with our current understanding to enrich both. I think that's kind of really how I see the ideal future. It's not easy, of course. I don't have the answers to that, but mm-hmm. I think making that as a goal is the way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. I wholeheartedly concur with you. How, as a matter of interest, in all of your personal psychedelic work, how much of that has been ceremonial, shamanistic versus clinical?
I think none of it has been clinical, particularly clinical. I've done my share of ayahuasca ceremonies, 7 over 3 retreats, and all in a Shipibo traditional context with a Shipibo trained shaman. You know, Shipibo peoples are Peruvian tradition, uh-huh. long history of ayahuasca use, and I really enjoy the tradition and how they set up ceremonies and all the things.
Yeah.
So I've done that, and then, you know, psilocybin, obviously many ceremonies with that over the years, and mostly in a kind of, you know, a kind of a co-constructed ceremonial context of just doing it intentionally with a group of friends, creating a container, you know, setting intentions, being very conscious about it, not really aligning it with any tradition, but I'm sure it's informed by a variety of things. And I've also had the kind of privilege of participating in a peyote ceremony with huichol shamans from Mexico. Mm. And that's a very traditional way of doing it. So I quite enjoyed that. And I very much enjoy these rich cultural containers. And I guess I suppose for some people it rubs them the wrong way, but I really, really enjoy dabbling in different traditions and experiencing different ways of doing things and appreciate the shamanic spiritual side as well. I definitely do. But that's not, I suppose, not as common among scientists as you'd hope.
No, well, this is why we're talking to you, because I think you sit smack bang on the line, and I think it's that's why it's so refreshing, right?
Yeah, definitely.
To have someone who has especially sat with the Shipibo, as you say, and done some ceremonial work, but then also you've got the scientific vibe. Well, I suppose it'll depend which indigenous tribes want to try to evolve alongside this, and I suppose at the same time it'll depend on the patient for want of a better word, there will be plenty of folks who we know, in fact, and including us, who will probably still prefer to work with these medicines in ceremonial situations, just because we can. We have the contacts. We've already done it several times in different parts of the world. And similarly to you, we enjoy the rich immersive experience of it. It's, you know, I don't want to go to the hospital, sit in a, and I'm sure it's not a white clinical room, but you know, ultimately it is in a clinic, and pop a pill and, you know, lie on a hospital bed for whatever it is, you know, a few hours. I actually enjoy the music. I enjoy the dirt, depending on what kind of Charlie you're in. You know, I enjoy the sort of the sound of the world waking up if you've done an ayahuasca ceremony overnight, and then you kind of the medicine's still with you when the dawn's occurring, all of those things.
But then that's choice, isn't it? As long as we always have the choice and that's not taken away, then
yeah,
that's okay.
Well, are you suggesting that the powers that be might attempt to take our choices away?
Well, whoever knows what's going to happen. But you know, the fact that all of this has been illegal for so long, unless you're in, you know, the countries where the tribes are still actively working with the medicine, you know, we should be able to have that choice. So if somebody wants to go into a clinic and be supervised, and it depends what you're going through, doesn't it? It depends why you're needing that treatment.
Yeah, and ultimately, not everybody can afford to hop on a plane and go to the Peruvian Sacred Valley or sit with the Nokikuin tribe in the Brazilian Amazon Basin, so on and so forth. So I suppose there'll be a place for all of it. Any question for you, Manesh? There was most of the psychedelic press talked about this week or two ago. There was, I think it was a Colorado psilocybin center that said they've just come out with their price list, and it's going to cost $2,800 for a one treatment. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I've been deep in my PhD, so I didn't take a look at it in detail, but I did see that. I think we're going to be looking at prices that are upwards of that amount. And if you think about it, let's say a psilocybin journey is 8 hours. If you take a high dose, it's capped at 8 hours. And a usual therapist is going to be anywhere from $120 to $200 an hour, at least in Canada. That's what I've seen. And so let's say 8 hours, that's already racking up $1,000 to $1,500. And then there's, if you're having preparatory and post psychotherapy sessions, let's say two on each end, that's another $400 to $600. And then the drug itself, which can be very expensive because companies have monopoly on it right now and it's not easily accessible, that's another maybe, you know, I don't know, a couple hundred dollars even. So then you're already at around $2,000 right there. And then if there's additional medical supervision, doctors are expensive, and how many hours you're going to have them for, that could rack up money very quick. And then there's a space rental as well is going to be factored in. And so these things add up really fast. And so really, you know, it's going to be, you know, if you're hoping for under the $2,000 for a session, that's going to be very unlikely in most cases. And that's why I really need to optimize insurance coverage and these other things. So it's quite tough given the way that models are set up and making sure people are compensated for their time.
So then it probably is cheaper to go to Peru.
Well, yeah. Uh-huh. Do you think there's a danger, therefore, that until this is accepted as a norm by the likes of Medicare and the insurance companies, do you think there's a danger, therefore, that actually only the wealthy are going to have access to such profound healing?
Yeah, I do think so. I think so initially. And it just depends on how fast the insurance coverage comes. And that might require a good amount of real world data, right? So it might be a little while. So that's a tough aspect from it. And I think that's a major challenge, how to make it scalable and accessible. That's a major, major challenge. And we don't have the answer necessarily.
And as you said, unfortunately, not to make sweeping generalizing comments, but big pharma's, you know, pretty much famous for monopolizing and premiumizing. So I suppose all the while these medicines are owned by monopolies, when I suspect they will be forever. I'm talking about the synthesized versions, of course. Then they will be driven by a market, won't they? But then I suppose ultimately that's the beautiful thing about psilocybin, for example, isn't it? Grows all over the world. It grows in the field down the road from us, out the cow paths. Mm-hmm. So I suppose it's just really about continuing to have the conversations, therefore, with people about responsible use of these medicines. That's the primary issue. I suppose it's a slightly doomsaying perspective here of, you know, a few years down the line where these medicines are all synthesized and mass produced. And then, of course, just like the fentanyl pandemic that's going on in North America that nobody talks about, there's a black market in highly potent pills containing DMT or psilocybin. And I have a general fear about what that looks like if any Tom, Dick or Harry can stop on a street corner in any city in the Western world and, you know, pick up the equivalent of 10 ayahuasca ceremonies and then go home and just eat those pills with no idea of what they're actually doing. What do you think?
Yeah, it's very, very accessible these days. There's so many websites that just outright sell illegal drugs, you know, and just completely outright. In Vancouver here, there are stores on the main streets, literally in big letters on the front, LSD, mushrooms, DMT, and they're just selling them in stores here in Vancouver. And I've had friends, I haven't gone to one of them yet, but I've seen them like driving by. But like you can just straight up buy them so easily. And so, yeah, this is why I find education is so important. And, you know, they're accessible if you want to buy them illegally. And there's also decriminalization movements all over North America. Mm-hmm. A lot of places, they are decriminalized. So you can legally, without risk of being prosecuted, acquire them in some way and take them in your home and do them, you know. And so in that respect, people need to be educated on the safety and everything we're talking about here. Because there might be this idea that, oh, they're decriminalized, they're in stores, I could just take it haphazardly and do it with some friends and it'll be fine. But no, even though physically it doesn't harm the brain, doesn't kill brain cells, doesn't damage your physiology, but psychologically it can traumatize you. You can have intense experiences. You can take it and walk into traffic if you take a high dose, you're not responsible. So all those things are true. As I said earlier, it's like, psychedelics aren't black or white. There's totally gray. They're whatever you make it. They could be either side. And that's been acknowledged since the beginning, right? So I think that's why doubling down on education and doing stuff like this, podcasts like this, and putting content out there and reaching different demographics, different age groups, different types of people to make sure this knowledge gets out there.
Amen to that, brother. So with that in mind, we should get close to wrapping up. What's on the cards for Manesh then in the next 12 months? What projects are you working on? What exciting things can you tease our audience with?
For sure. So on the content creation side, I'm really planning to ramp up my creation on YouTube, start making more YouTube videos again. Also a lot of content on Instagram and expanding beyond just psychedelics to more about mental health and trauma and nervous system regulation, as well as neuroscience, and really just expanding to provide practical and scientifically grounded information on all these things. So that's in the docket for me now that I'm about to finish my PhD and have a good amount more free time, at least for temporarily. And then in August, I moved to San Francisco to work with the psychedelic researcher Robin Carhart-Harris, used to be in London, and yeah, he's quite famous. He was just on the Andrew Huberman podcast. Uh-huh. And so I've been collaborating with Robin for some years, and he moved to San Francisco and invited me to join him for a 2-year position. And
that's
so I start that in August, and I'll be working on, I'm super excited. I'll be working on some big psilocybin related brain imaging studies, combining different measures of, you know, psychological functioning and how they relate to the psilocybin experience, and how different states within the psychedelic psilocybin experience relate to the brain, and a whole variety of things, which we're taking another whole podcast to unpack. So I'm doing a lot of cool stuff with him coming up soon as well, and continuing to work with Entheotech, and we're expanding as a company quite well. And yeah. Those three things are taking up all my time, as you might imagine.
Well, that is all very exciting stuff. Yeah. So would you like to share your socials and your website and any other places that you want people to find you?
Yeah, definitely. So on Instagram and YouTube, it's The Psychedelic Scientist. I'm also on Twitter, but I don't use Twitter too much these days. Too much of a negative place for me, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And you can find me on LinkedIn, just Manesh Gurn. I'm also currently developing my website with a couple others. So that'll be maneshgurin.com, which will be up soon. And I'll have a whole media portfolio and all the things there. And then my course, if you go to psychedeliceducationcenter.com, it'll be listed on that website. And the name of the course is Psychedelic Neuroscience Demystified.
Maybe we'll see you
and
there.
So, yeah, you can find that there. You could, yeah. Yeah, the next cohort will probably be in a month-ish or a month and a half. So definitely stay in the loop there. And yeah, that's basically it for me.
Brilliant. Have you got anything you you want to leave our audience with? Any thoughts about psychedelics in general? Perhaps for people who've never worked with psychedelics.
Hmm. I think it's the case that they're going to be more and more prevalent. They're going to be huge in mental health more than they already are starting to be. And so it's great for people to get informed. As I mentioned, there's a lot of resources online. Quick Google search can find your resources. Get informed, see what this revolution in mental health is going to be, and share it with others. A lot of people are having a rough time. Mental health problems are spiking throughout the developed world, at least. And we need new treatments. Old treatments and drugs are just inadequate in so many ways. And psychedelics represent a real potential new paradigm. And so inform yourself, educate yourself, spread it, and help push these things forward.
Amazing. Thank you. You got anything you'd like to say to Manish before we close off?
No, just thank you so much for sharing all of this and for getting this out into the world and continuing your research. We need it.
Yeah, thanks, Manish.
For sure, my pleasure.
Really enjoyed having this conversation. And as for having more things to discuss on other podcast episodes, we'd love to get you back if you've enjoyed yourself. So let's stay in touch. Carry on with your journey.
Yeah, definitely.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, brother.
Cool.
Peace and love.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Take care.